From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, kiss your gummies goodbye. Texas is on the verge of a total ban on hemp-derived THC.
And to date, there are no hemp-related deaths.
Lawsuits are coming after the GOP command to put the Ten Commandments in all classrooms.
It's really an attack on our democracy.
And lawmakers promised that they would do something about water scarcity in Texas, but did they deliver?
And when we look at the scale of the need for water supply investment in Texas, $20 billion is a drop in the proverbial bucket.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Senate Bill 3 is sitting on Governor Greg Abbott's desk. If he doesn't veto it, all hemp THC products in Texas will be banned on September 1st, 2025. This includes popular items like vapes, drinks, and edibles. Only non-intoxicating cannabinoids like CBD and CBG would be legal. This means that the $8 billion hemp THC industry in Texas would go up in smoke, eliminating approximately 50,000 jobs, and there would be a loss of access to the therapeutics beneficial for various health conditions. Thomas Wynn Stanley is the executive vice president of edibles.com.
What is problematic in many ways is looking at a recent poll from the University of Houston. Around 80% of constituents support some form of access to THC products. And I think there's a very deep inherent disconnect between the bill that is currently on the desk of Governor Abbott and the overwhelming sentiments of Texas residents. And I think that is a deeply inherent conflict that is not reflective of the people who elected these officials. And I think that is it's going to create some very serious adverse conditions for the marketplace.
Veteran, respected journalist Jeremy Wallace was at a press conference this week with the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Asked Dan Patrick about, why are we doing a complete and total ban on these products? Why don't we just make them unavailable to anyone under 18, anyone under 21, or set the number you want? And here's the reaction from Dan Patrick.
I understand wanting to protect children, but you have grown adults who are using these products too. Is there a way to do this where grown adults could still have access to these products?
No, look, we don't want adults having this either. What are you, crazy? You want to go home and eat a bag of this tonight? See if you're here tomorrow? This is what we focus on, kids, because that's where they built the shops. But adults are buying this stuff too. Make no mistake. We want to protect the 20 and the 30 and the 40 and the 50-year-olds too. We don't want anybody buying anything off the shelf that could kill them or ruin their mental state for the rest of their lives.
All right. Yeah. So if I can get your reaction, Thomas, to what Dan Patrick is saying, it's not just about kids, not just about young adults. They don't want this in the hands of anyone. How can we call Texas a free state, free, freedom-loving state, if the legislature is taking this away?
I don't know that you can any longer. And I think what is most discouraging about that is even the lieutenant governor's statement about not allowing adults to have the right to choose. By comparison, there is this glaring double standard when you look at things like firearms and access to firearms. In 2022, Texas experienced over 4,000 gun-related deaths. And instead of punishing, the entire industry and taking away guns, well, they codified laws to help preserve it. You could make the same argument about alcohol and tobacco that have documented severe health implications to it. And to date, there are no hemp-related deaths. Nobody has used hemp in a way that has caused any major concerns. Sure, are there, symptomatic issues? There's no question about that. But we are creating a major double standard that, in a regressive way socially, takes us back to reefer madness. And arguably, I think in some ways, is worse because we know so much more about this category. We know so much more about this industry. And an industry doesn't grow this fast under federal protection without some level of safety and security. And I think, unfortunately, the lieutenant governor has a very clear view that is not a reflection of his constituents. And I think a lot of the information that he shares is far off base from the reality of this marketplace. And unfortunately, I don't know that the reality that is coming with a ban like this is understood, is that when you introduce prohibition, you are creating a more adverse market where the vacuum is filled by the black market, by unregulated products. You can take away access to these legal products, but that does not remove the demand for these types of products. And people will find them. And now they will find them through alternative means. And I think even more concerning to taking away them all, there is an implementation of penalties and jail time that is more egregious than marijuana policy in the state. And so there is a significant disconnect here that I don't know has been fully interpreted as the outcost of banning something that is as desired by these individuals in Texas. And I think that is exceedingly concerning.
So there are a lot of people who have invested money, putting up small businesses, people who have gotten jobs, who've worked in this industry. That industry doesn't exist anymore, starting on September 1st. What happens there?
You know, it's incredibly unfortunate. I will say one thing, you know, having worked in the cannabis industry and now coming over to the hemp industry, I think hemp democratized access to THC in a way that cannabis never could. And unfortunately, this punishes the entrepreneurs who are trying to do right. And it creates it sends a very clear message to these entrepreneurs and these business owners and these employees and the wages that are going to disappear, that, you know, there's no path forward for an emerging industry that has federal protections to exist in a state where freedom should be above all things.
So you think there'll be a reckoning at the ballot box?
Well, I think it's not as much about Democrats or Republicans, because in the last 20 years, support for cannabis policy at a national landscape, that this is one of the very few bipartisan issues that we're seeing both sides of the aisle come into support for. I think if this bill does go through, I think a lot of Texans are going to spend some time thinking about what does it mean to elect somebody in Texas and what should they stand for versus what the bill of sale finally was in terms of action, which did not meet the standards reflective of their demographics.
People are saying this, the alcohol lobby and the pharmaceutical lobby are the ones that are driving the bus on the ban on THC. Do you see that?
I think there is a very good case to be made that is occurring. I think if you look at campaign donations, I think there's a lot of political interest that is in the background of these conversations. And unfortunately, I think we are seeing some of those political interests prevail here.
Thomas Winstanley is the executive vice president of edibles.com. Texas is poised to enact a law mandating the display of the Ten Commandments in all public school classrooms. Senate Bill 10 has passed both legislative chambers. It awaits Governor Abbott's signature, which he is expected to provide. The law would take effect on September 1st. A group of civil liberty organizations are preparing to sue Texas over SB 10. They cite the 1980 Supreme Court decision in Stone v. Graham, which struck down a similar law in Kentucky. Rachel Lazar is the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
So our lawsuit is going to be very well positioned to address this, because in America and in Texas, we have a commitment, a constitutional one, to religious freedom. And the Texas Constitution, just like the American one, reflects the truth that the way that you can guarantee religious freedom is by separating church and state. It's pro-religion and pro-religious freedom. And I like to start there, David, with the basics, because We have so much disinformation right now about church-state separation that we need to come back to the basics. And the basics are that the people who founded my organization, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, almost 80 years ago, were all people of faith. They were deeply religious people, Methodist ministers and Seventh-day Adventists and the president of the Southern Baptist Association and others who were extremely concerned about what happens to religion when the government co-opts it, you know, as much as they were also concerned about religious freedom. And that's really what's at stake in Texas. And our lawsuit will be on very strong grounds. We filed a similar lawsuit in Louisiana and won so far in the federal district court under both the free exercise clause and the non-establishment clause. Two victories and one lawsuit.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here in favor of the Ten Commandments. And what's the harm? What could go wrong just posting the Ten Commandments on the wall in the classroom?
All right. Where do I begin? Ten Commandments are great. I'm Jewish. We honor the Ten Commandments in my faith, and I'm wearing my personal hat right now. But the point is, children, school children, are captive audiences. They're forced to go to school. These are public schools. They need to be inclusive and secular in order to honor the religious freedom of all families and students. They also risk teaching children things about the Ten Commandments for the families that honor them. And not all families do, right? There are Buddhist families and Hindu families and non-religious families. And there are families that honor a different version of the Ten Commandments than were in this bill, right? So there are sort of families all over the place. But families that value the Ten Commandments, truly value the Ten Commandments, want their churches and their houses of worship to be the places that are teaching their kids about these laws, about these codes of our faith, not public school teachers, because public school teachers aren't Sunday school teachers, and they shouldn't be, and they're not qualified to be.
So this is established constitutional law that posting the Ten Commandments is a violation of the freedom of religion, losing in the courts today. What's behind the effort to put this back in the classroom to pass this law, even though it doesn't really have the legal standing to do so?
I mean, that's a great question, David. And I think what we're seeing all around the country today is this emboldened religious extremism. It's really an attack on our democracy. Because if you think about it, our democracy is premised on the idea of freedom for all. But this, what we sometimes call Christian nationalism, many Christians don't actually view it as Christian at all, by the way. So sometimes I like to refer to it as religious extremism, but, you know, this is incredibly dangerous for our democracy because its goal is anti-democratic. Its goal is to have the government favor one set of people based on their religious beliefs over all others. And I think it's significant that, you know, in our Louisiana lawsuit, we have a lot of plaintiffs who are clergy, who are parents, right? That lawsuit is on behalf of parents and students in Louisiana, but a lot of the parents are clergy. There's Presbyterian clergy couple, there's a Unitarian clergy, and there's some non-religious folks too. And I think it's really important to demonstrate that there are tons of folks who are the wrong kind of Christian, according to the way that the government is playing favorites here. And it's also articulated in a sort of a way that leans Protestant. There's there's language that says, thou shalt not make to thyself any graven images. And there are a lot of Catholics that contest that sort of representation of the Ten Commandments. And, you know, because some of the statues, little statues of Mary and things that they have been called graven images. There's another commandment in the Texas version that just passed that says, you know, thou shalt not kill. But, you know, in the Jewish version, it says that you shouldn't murder. And the distinction there is that sometimes, you know, under Jewish law, it's okay to kill, like in self-defense or in war. So I'm just sort of drawing on some of the differences, even for the faiths that share the Ten Commandments, and the way the government playing favorites and school teachers being ill-prepared to kind of decipher these differences and respond to questions about them even is affecting religion. And David, just one more point on this. Like we're all witnessing what's going on with the Trump administration and universities across the country. And basically because the government is funding, you know, to the tune of a lot of money, some of these universities, you know, the government has an ability often to affect the teachings of the universities, or at least it's really trying to through, you know, controlling the funding. This is exactly what we're trying to avoid with religion, right? And you know, today it's the Ten Commandments, but, you know, what is it next? And it's also, I guess, even in this version of the Ten Commandments, it's like the government is getting to decide how to teach about our religion. And that's, you know, really dangerous in terms of sullying religion. And it's why we have always been supported by people of faith. I mean, we Americans United for Separation of Church and State and the cause of church-state separation, and we always will, because people who I speak to every day, clergy, are very concerned about the government potentially interfering with religious teachings. And as Dr. King said, the government should not be the servant of the state or the master. Religion should not be the servant or the master of the state, because it's the conscience mm-hmm. of the state, right? And that's really an important concept.
So do you need people to complain, or test case, or, you know, a plaintiff to sue?
Yes, yes. And I am talking to all parents out there in Texas. Please, if you are concerned about how this law will soon to be signed into law will affect your family, please contact us at Americans United everywhere. We're at Americans United on social media, but our website is at au.org. And please, you can report you can do the equivalent of reporting a violation, because this is, you know, this is going to be a facial challenge. The fact that this law was passed and it's going into you know, it's presuming it's signed very soon, it's going into effect on September 1. That's enough for parents who have concerns to be part of a lawsuit. And we are here for you, parents. This is what we exist for, to protect your family's religious freedom, your neighbor's religious freedom, and your state's patriotic commitment to religious freedom. So please contact us. We're here for you at au.org.
Rachel Lazar is president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Going into the legislative session of 2025, hopes were high that this would be the session when lawmakers would make big strides in addressing the state's ongoing water shortage. The water challenges of Texas could no longer be ferried away. Solutions are needed for the state's pressing water challenges, focusing on infrastructure, investment, regulatory reform, and environmental considerations. Tom Insmeager is the policy director at the National Wildlife Federation Texas Coast and Water Program.
Yes. I mean, even 2 years ago, we knew that this one was going to be another water session. In the previous session, we saw the creation of the Texas Water Fund and the appropriation of the first $1 billion to that fund. The conversation around the creation of that fund sort of emphasized the need for much more than that $1 billion. And the Texas Water Fund was sort of seen as the first step in the right direction. That was capitalized on this session with further appropriations to the fund, as well as the dedication of tax revenue over a 20-year period to the tune of $1 billion a year.
Right. So there are two major water bills that would provide some funding, an immediate $2.5 billion for water development in the state of Texas that would be allocated for infrastructure and local water systems that are in need of major repair. A lot of rural areas and smaller cities just don't have the money or the system in order to actually do that. And then there's that, as you mentioned, SB7, which is a $20 billion expenditure, but it would be $1 billion a year. And where does that money come from?
So this is the a dedication of sales tax revenue, which is sort of a new funding mechanism for water. It's crafted to sort of look like the funding mechanism that was constructed for our state roads over the past several years and has been pretty successful in that arena. And so coming into this session, there was the idea that we'd try that out on water, and that's what ended up being successful.
So problem solved. Yahoo. All done. Thanks, everybody. Not quite.
So,
right?
It is a step in the right direction. The good thing about it, a step in the right direction, is it helps you build the momentum, and we want to capitalize on that momentum going forward. When we look at the scale of the need for water supply investment in Texas, $20 billion is hugely significant. It is a wonderful accomplishment, but it is a drop in the proverbial bucket. The estimates of total need continue to grow and will continue to grow as we release new water supply plans and things like that. But I think a lot of us have heard the estimate of $120 billion a year that comes from things like the degree to which Water Development Board financial assistance programs are already oversubscribed. And so we're taking the dollar amounts of projects that are already in the hopper, so to speak, and need funding. And so we know that the $20 billion is just going to end up being just a portion of that. So we'd like to continue taking further steps in the right direction.
Being the jaundice-eyed skeptic that I am, I wonder, you know, we're having a lot of development in Central Texas. People are outcrying that, you know, we don't have the water for all of this development, and whether this $20 billion, that's a lot of money, if that is just really to try to relieve some of the pressure that so that this development can continue, it doesn't really solve the overall problem.
I think that there are a myriad programs that this funding is going to be able to help support. And they were created over the years for many, many different issues. You know, 50% of this funding is going to be going towards water supply or future water needs. And so that is the implementation of projects in the state water plan, as well as the pursuance of technologies that bring new water sources online to be added into that water supply planning, things like desalination, or even importation of water from other places and things like that. But the other 50%, it goes to programs that have been created for things like compliance with the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, and the replacement and rehabilitation of aging infrastructure, the expansion of infrastructure to accommodate new development and new demand. So I think that, you know, the relief of some of the pressure in Central Texas related to growth is going to be one of the benefits of this new funding, but I don't think it's the only one. And I don't know if it was the sole purpose either.
I don't know how many billions of dollars you're going to spend, but that's not going to make it rain. So what do they want to do with the money to create more water?
So under the New Water Supply Fund for Texas, which is sort of part of this forward-looking investment part of the funding, we're looking at things like desalination, not only of seawater, but of brackish groundwater. We're looking at produced water, the treatment of water that is produced through fracking in the oil and gas industry. We're looking at the importation of water from neighboring states. Some of that has been in the news lately this session. And so it's really talking about innovative sources that we know are out there and are somewhat proven and could add to our water supply portfolio, but haven't been deployed yet here in Texas.
So let's talk about seawater desalination. It's expensive, and the water is all the way over there at the Gulf. There was some chatter about this Texas water grid. I don't know if they're still talking about that or not, but moving water around the state, we're still talking about a lot of money.
We are, and it is an expensive problem. You know, moving water is not cheap. It's power intensive, as well as just the construction of pipelines and things like that to hold it. It's very heavy, and so conveying it requires a lot of power. But you know, there are parts of the state that just don't have the resources necessary to, you know, if you look out at projections over the next 50 years in the state water plan, it's just sort of clear that there are parts of the state that are not as water rich, don't have as much depth in their portfolio. And the idea, I think, behind some of this new water supply funding was to create a system where water could be produced and delivered to these areas. that water supply grid is not being talked about in the same terms that it was at the beginning of the session. But the final legislation does still promote things like regionalization. It promotes the development of standards and infrastructure based on those standards to convey new water supplies and connect it into existing water systems that communities and water utilities across Texas are already administering. So the goals of the water grid are still achievable with the final legislation that we've ended up with. It just doesn't look the same as it did 6 months ago.
And where is conservation on this shopping list of things to do? Because with all this money that they now have, I mean, patching up old water systems, I guess that's conservation, but encouraging
Sure.
people to use less water, is that also part of the plan?
Sure. Conservation is important when we're talking about expenditure because the cheapest source of water is going to be what's already in our communities and maybe we could capture and utilize more effectively. And so you mentioned water loss. That is an issue. We did a study a couple of years ago showing that as of 2020, Texas utilities were losing about 571,000 acre feet per year through water loss. And that's between the water plant and our homes in the, in our distribution piping infrastructure. And so the 50% of this funding that is goes through Water Development Board financial assistance programs for current needs can fund projects that address water leakage issues. There's a lot of line replacements, a lot of aging infrastructure in Texas, so we see a lot of line replacement projects funded through water development programs. And so we anticipate seeing a lot of those projects funded with this money over the years. The first $1 billion investment in the previous cycle was put largely to that effect. About 75% of it was left to the discretion of the Water Development Board, and they are planning to spend that on conservation and water loss mitigation. On additional conservation strategies, you know, there are things like rainwater harvesting and purple pipe systems that can much more effectively make use of the water that's already in our communities. These projects are, these projects tend to be a little less expensive than some of the other ones, like the seawater desalination, for example, on an acre-foot basis. But the financial resources are still needed to pull them off. And so this funding will help communities to implement the projects to help them meet the goals in their water conservation plans, whether it's residential reductions or the installation of things like water reuse systems.
Are they still thinking about new reservoirs? Is that really a solution?
Part of the logic behind the creation of the new Water Supply for Texas Fund and the idea that these supplies might need to be sought further afield was that some of the reservoirs currently appearing in the water plan are probably not feasible. They've been there for a long time, or maybe they're very controversial and unlikely to really happen
I mean,
as
we have
planned.
empty water reservoirs right now.
Totally, yeah. And there, there's been a lot of controversy about, some of the ones that are like Marvin Nichols, for example. There was a feasibility review published last year by the Water Development Board, and that one's been in the state water plan, I believe, since it was first published. And I think there's an attitude that, some of these strategies in the state water plan are not going to work out, and if you take those out, you see some gaps start to appear in our water portfolio looking over the next several decades. And so the Senator Charles Perry out of Lubbock was the one who filed or who really developed this idea for the new water supply. And this gap is what he's trying to solve for.
Tom Insminger is the policy director at the National Wildlife Federation Texas Coast and Water Program. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters at tpr.org. And download the show wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.